I wish I didn't look. I wish my background wasn't so haphazard here. Like, my house looks nice, but
I don't know why it
here.
even matters. You don't even use video on your
Wait, oh,
podcast.
but you're using video though, aren't you? You're going to be using this, so
Oh shit, you're
aren't you?
right. Never mind.
We just talked about this like 1 minute ago. You were there. Wow, is this what it's like to talk to me? It totally is.
Sorry, it's the COVID brain fog.
Yeah, I think so. Hi, Amanda. Welcome back to the show, old friend of the show. Well, we just had you on, or I was on your show, and now you're on my show. But we cross-publish these things anyways, so we're just double dipping into the dips all over again. But we're here to talk about this that we the way we kind of phrased it was like the never-ending chronicles of Western projection, China, like the China edition. So 2016, 2017, I guess a little bit earlier before that too, we saw the Uyghur genocide story. That was like, and they've since like basically dumped it. Like, they're just like, sorry, it doesn't exist anymore. Sorry. Like, the genocide, just like they stopped using the G word.
Oh my gosh. But one thing I want to bring up about the Uyghur genocide is like I think they're called the Xinjiang victims
Victims
database.
database.
They
Yeah. Oh my
recently
God.
posted supposed
For the one was an
photos
actor.
of the Urumqi police force. And there are I don't know how many of these like small square photos, and then you zoomed in, and one was a ho very famous Hong Kong actor, Chow Yun-fat, and then another very famous Kanto pop star and Hong Kong actor, Andy Lau, like literally one of the most famous people in China and Hong Kong. And then like another picture was just like a photo, like a picture of a cartoon character.
I mean, because the thing is, like, I think about this a lot too, especially in the Iranian context, is that like because they have monopolistic control, like the imperialists enjoy kind of monopolistic control over the discourse and how they like stomp out, like the first thing they did with like the Ukraine invasion was just like stomp out any Russian channel on YouTube. Just stomp them out. Just press delete. It's done. You don't get to be on YouTube. That's it, if you're Russian. Same with the other things. It's like same thing. And I feel like this is just how they do it. And so that the consequence of that though is that that's a double-edged sword. Because sure, on the one hand, you enjoy this monopoly that like no one questions you when you like make up stuff, and like the stories pass through like the sieve of the mainstream news on anything, right? Like it's a beautiful system. It's like a terrarium. But at the same time though, like when you have no one arguing back with you, and when you have no one like engaging you, I feel like in the end you just like have nothing to do and you're bored. So like I feel like with at least the Iranian regime changers, like the professional ones, like the hackiest ones. I mean, there's different colors of them, obviously. Like there's different varieties of them, which is actually interesting. But ultimately, like because they don't have to face anybody who argues against them, like at least on the question of regime change in Iran, that like they can just say anything. Like they can just, and that's how we got, Iran is murdering 15,000 people today story viral that went happened. So like this is, I feel like in this situation we're in now, you can just say anything you want, and then but the consequence of that is that like they get wackier and wackier, the lies and like just the stories get wackier, and like the disinfo, and even if people believe it, like, and of course some people will, because people will always believe things about enemy states. That's like why propaganda works.
And then, what's ridiculous about it is that it's taken as such a given that like places like Iran and China are these like such repressive authoritarian states that even if you do push back on the propaganda, like when people were like, this presented evidence that 15,000 people executed was a lie. People would respond by being like, well, doesn't it say something that, maybe Iran, the government could execute all of these people? Or they would say, like, Or they would point to like the one protester who was executed and they'd be like, see, see? And it's just like, well, yeah, that's terrible. And I don't support that. But isn't there like a pretty wide gulf between one person executed and 15,000? There is ultimately,
like, they suffer from like, at least from what I can tell, like, and I am like psychologizing, but I do feel like the lack of dialectical engagement of any kind of the of like beyond just like your own little community of like whatever you represent, because in some, I feel like at least in the Iran case, there are these sort of diverse populations that you have people who regime changers who sort of talk like this and regime changers who talk like that, and they kind of they fight with each other, and a lot of times they can only go about and like rove through the halls for each other and yell at each other, and so that's what a lot of them end up doing. They can't really do anything and they affect no change in Iran ultimately. So that like, I feel like the story here, the episode that we're talking about today, is kind of part of that story, but a little bit more insidious, because this story of this part of the Chronicles, the never ending Chronicles of Western Projection, it had a scientific sort of pseudo. Yeah. It had a scientific sounding base to it, like an economic and like sociological base to it, that debt trap diplomacy. Like it sounds so like official and smart and like a technical word.
A win-win partnership or a debt trap? At a summit with African leaders, China's president dismissing claims of a new colonialism, as he promised $60 billion in fresh funding for the continent. Can Xi Jinping's guests, though, afford to pay him back? Will his big Belt and Road initiatives make them beholden to Beijing?
And it's splashing out billions of dollars across the globe in concessional loans to developing countries for infrastructure projects. But what happens when countries, often poorer than China, can't pay them back?
Experts warn Beijing is offering up bad loans as a form of entrapment to gain influence and power across the world.
Here's how it works. Poorer nations are lured by China's offer of cheap loans for transformative infrastructure projects. Then, when predictably, these countries are unable to keep up with their repayments, Beijing can demand concessions or other advantages in exchange for debt relief. This is known as debt trap diplomacy.
The head of MI6 last year accused China of using debt traps to gain leverage over countries. The argument is that when countries cannot repay the loans, they are forced to hand over infrastructure assets to China, assets such as ports, which are useful for China's ability to project its power around the world.
The war in Ukraine is forcing countries across Europe to reconsider doing business with Russia. Now, it comes at a time when Moscow's most powerful ally, China, continues to expand its economic interests across European countries. But there are allegations of worker exploitation, environmental damage, and so-called debt traps, where Beijing has stepped in to lend billions of dollars. China denies the accusations and insists it's a reliable partner and that offers investment where others are unwilling.
But it actually rolls off the tongue nicely. Do I have to admit that like it is the kind of, and these are the kinds of turns of phrases and like little sort of, I would say, like wares that like writers and pundits and like, you know, podcasters and stuff kind of have, you know, in our part of the media sphere, because, you know, whatever, that's like what you do as part of the, as part of like an info warrior, is that you come up with these like catchy little phrases. So I feel like this story of the debt trap diplomacy is kind of like a nice case study in these like never ending chronicles. And it's so nakedly, like when you just scratch the surface a little bit, the whole artifice just falls away. It's like an old like Western set. You like push just a little bit and it just like falls back and you're like, oh, all of that like ink spilled was for this. Like the substance was actually this. So maybe you could kind of like talk a little bit about it. Talk about your article. Talk about the basic sort of the origin of this term. And let's get into it.
Yeah. So this idea, there's like a very pervasive idea that U.S. politicians and U.S. corporate media, that they have this narrative about China that it engages in debt trap diplomacy. Like, the narrative goes that it ensnares these developing countries into these predatory loans, which China knows that they will never be able to pay back. And these loans have all kinds of onerous terms and conditions. And, you know, China grants loans to develop infrastructure, right? And so they convince these countries, these poor countries, to build infrastructure as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, with China knowing that they'll default, at which point China seizes that asset after, like, the country is unable to pay back the loan. They seize that asset as collateral, and they use that as a way of extending its own military or geostrategic influence. So there's, like, this, like, really predatory kind of plan, supposedly, that China engages in. And, you know, it's always, like, as part of this, like, debt for, like, asset swap. And evidence of this is used to support this, like, very commonly held belief about China engaging in imperialism or colonization of the global South, especially in Africa. And, you know, this is another example of what you were talking about, of the U.S. projecting its own actions, its own crimes onto China. Because, you know, like, what pedestal does the West have to stand on to accuse any other country of imperialism or colonialism, right? So the idea of debt trap diplomacy is, like, a pretty recent invention. It really first appeared in 2017 when this academic paper that was published by an Indian think tank was talking about the Chinese financing of Sri Lanka's Hambantota port. And this is really, like, the one example that a lot of people point to as evidence of Chinese debt trap diplomacy. So this phrase and this concept was used in this academic paper that was published by this Indian think tank. And then this idea was then picked up by these two Harvard graduate students in 2018, and they published a paper accusing China of what they call debt book diplomacy. And they accused China of leveraging accumulated debt to achieve its strategic aims. That's a quote. And this paper that was written by the Harvard graduate students, it became really widely cited among media publications. And then the idea made its way into Washington and intelligence circles. So in October of 2018, Mike Pence was speaking at the Hudson Institute. And, you know, he said, and this is a quote, "In fact, China uses so-called debt diplomacy to expand its influence. Today, that country is offering hundreds of billions of dollars in infrastructure loans to governments from Asia to Africa to Europe and even Latin America. Yet the terms of these loans are opaque at best, and the benefits invariably flow overwhelmingly to Beijing." And by November of 2018, so same year as when that paper was published by the Harvard grad students, a Google search of the phrase debt trap diplomacy generated nearly 2 million results on Google. So it's this phrase that really, like, gained a lot of steam in just a very short period of time. And there have been a few scholars, Deborah Brottingham is, like, one of the most famous, who have done, like, really good work debunking this idea. But despite, you know, her work debunking it, I think most people still really believe that this is a thing, and what, you know, Western corporate media even promotes it as truth. And I talked about this in my article, but there was this one really egregious instance where BBC News even edited an interview with Deborah Brottingham, who, as I said earlier, she's a scholar known for her work challenging the idea of this, like, debt trap diplomacy myth. Well, she did an interview with them, and they edited her interview to only include her explanation of the concept of the debt trap diplomacy myth itself, and they completely edited out all of the evidence that she had cited against it, which led listeners to believe that she was in fact claiming that the narrative was true. So, you know, the purpose of these kinds of stories, whether or not they're true, it's not, I mean, I don't think it's like, I think it's kind of immaterial. The purpose is the circulation itself, to repeat it over and over again until people accept it as truth. So by the time people actually do the research into it, and look into like the actual contracts and the agreements into the paperwork to debunk it, they face an uphill battle because most people have already accepted it as truth. Like another thing I want to bring up is like in April of 2021, Antony Blinken was speaking to the Young Leaders Initiative, Young African Leaders Initiative. And this was like a Zoom panel. And he said, this is a quote, "We're not asking anyone to choose between the United States or China, but I would encourage you to ask those tough questions, to dig beneath the surface, to demand transparency, and to make informed choices about what is best for you and your countries. If someone is coming along and saying, I'm going to invest a lot of money in your country, but it's a loan, so that means you have a debt and you're going to have to pay it back someday. And if that debt is too great and you can't pay it back, then I'm going to own the asset in question." And of course, he was referring to this debt for asset swap. That's the basis of China's debt trap diplomacy. And I don't know, this is like very like illustrating of the U.S. paternalistic attitude toward Africa. You know, like, look at the U.S.'s own history in Africa. You know, like, it's basically like, it's just like basically a site of resource extraction and exploitation, and they have like military bases set up all around it. Like, you know, they have like AFRICOM set up in it to basically protect its own right to like keep the extraction of resources flowing toward, you know, Western capitalists. And, you know, it's, you know, currently sanctioning over 9 countries in Africa, I believe. And then, you know, Zimbabwe has been under U.S. sanctions for like 21 years. So, you know, like, the U.S. history in Africa is a very like exploitative, like very sordid exploitated one. And, you know, here's the Secretary of State of the U.S., you know, telling African leaders, you know, like who they should or shouldn't engage in business relations with, like what right do they have, you know, as if, you know, these African leaders, they can't judge for themselves, you know, who to do business with. They can't judge for themselves, you know, like who offers them a better deal. I guess that's like the origins of the myth, and I can probably like go into, you know, the specificities like of the different countries that are often used as examples if we want to in a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the outset, this is like the kind of like, you know, the egregiousness of the Occidental mind at work, like just the audacity and the shamelessness and the profound need and like drive and like, you know, to like drag down the world with them and I mean that in like multiple senses in the world, is that like the US hegemon needs to tell the rest of the world is, yeah, this is the way hegemony works. Anyone else who is a hegemon is a hegemon like us, right? And so that's how you get people are like, oh, Russia is imperialist, China is imperialist, Iran is imperialist, which is you kind of figure that, like, okay, so like the people who kind of say this argument, I mean, a lot of times it's like you figure like some of these people are fake or they're bots or whatever, but like some people actually believe this because they've internalized the like just never ending and profound and like violently effective like US propaganda machine around its enemy countries, right? The fact that like it works so omnipresent, and it's so omnipresent, and it has different functionings for different settings for different countries. So the way that it works for Iran is completely different than the way it works for Russia, for instance, right? And it's different for the way it works for China. And I would think that, like, I mean, sure, you can kind of notice similar patterns in how like rogue states get constructed in the whole machine of manufacturing consent in the US and like the Anglophone world. But like it seems to me a psychological, like, again, I'm psychologizing here, but like Westerner people in the West are of a certain mentality, of a certain education level. I think this is like it transcends the classes. They need an Orient. They need like a despotic Orient to exist in their minds. It's like a lodestar, or it's like something that they can measure their own societies against, which is why like it's so lucrative to be, say, like a comprador, right? Because your job is to confirm the horrible image you have, to confirm and elaborate and detail and like illustrate the horrible image you have of like country X, right? And so like Gordon Chang, or what's her name, the woman who changed her name to Christ, Melissa Chan. Well, I mean, I'm talking about the Iranian one. God, Masi Ali-Najad, Masume is her name. She changed it to Christ, which is the weirdest thing in the world. Because, you know, you figure a lot of them, too, have to pretend to be evangelical, because that is one market of, like, the Iranian dissident brigade. That's, like, one big corner of it is, like, evangelical money. But, like, you know, this is, you know, I can't even like fathom like what it takes for like a Western person to sit there like living on stolen indigenous land and enjoying the fruits of all of like the violent rape, theft, and like colonial murder of like Western concerns and like the sort of oligarchs who make up our life here, and yet like still in the same breaths like hold other countries to such an insane standard that like any amount of influence in the world or any amount of like foreign policy in the world is tantamount to imperialism. I mean, imperialism, like you're talking about like Paul Bremer or whatever, like sitting in like a little, like something out of WWF, like ring in Baghdad, because they just had occupied the country with their like 250,000 military men. Like that's imperialism. Like when you talk about like when you're talking about like, you know, that's something that like, I don't know, to me is so obvious and clear. But to talk about like the fact that like Iran, say for instance in Iran, right, like you'll hear this from some people that, oh, Iran does Syria, is occupying Syria, Iran is occupying Iraq, which is like Iran has like alliances with these governments and factions inside those countries, and they align with them, and these are like their neighbors, and they're like they're the countries that surround them, that they're going to have any kind of relations. But in that framework, when you say like imperialism, it's just like it just cheapens all of the violence that the US perpetuates to the point where like nothing means anything, that like the existence of a country is imperialism in like the minds, in like the Child Mind Institute of the Western left specifically. But I think in general, it's that Orientalism thing combined with the need to feel superior and that like you live in the good part of the world.
Well, like this charge of imperialism when it comes to China, a lot of times it's just, the evidence is just like China engaging in some kind of bilateral relations or like bilateral agreements with like a developing country, right? And, you know, like China, you know, whether you like it or not, has a policy of like non-intervention. It saw what happened to the Soviet Union like 30 years ago, how it was like constantly undermined and attacked. And it bases its foreign policy on not interfering with like the political sovereignty of other countries. And like you can like disagree with it. You can disagree with some, with like whatever countries it chooses to engage with. But that is its foreign policy. And in the case of Africa, you know, like Africa is severely underdeveloped, and it's severely underdeveloped because like in large part due to like Western imperialism and Western colonialism. And so like what do you need to develop? Well, you need infrastructure. And China grants loans to build infrastructure. To develop, you're going to need hospitals, you're going to need roads, you're going to need telecoms networks, you're going to need infrastructure. And, you know, this is like, this is what China grants loans to developing countries for. And a lot of times, if you ask the leaders of these countries whether they prefer Chinese loans or whether they prefer Western loans, a lot of times they tell you that they prefer these Chinese loans because China, unlike, you know, the IMF or the West or whatever, they grant you a loan, but they don't, you know, use that loan as a way of interfering in your political affairs, right? IMF loans are often, well, not often, but they are conditional upon that country like instituting a bunch of like structural adjustment policies and economic reforms, you know, which include like cutting back of pensions, scaling back the state in economic affairs, privatizing the public sector, cutting back on energy subsidies, and all this kind of stuff that make the country like more attractive to Western capitalist investment. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, these reforms end up hurting the poor and working class in these countries. And these reform, and because of that, these reforms often lead to political instability. So, you know, like that, like making the loans conditional upon that is like a major, major violation of political sovereignty. But I don't know, like going back to like this lie of debt trap diplomacy, if you look at the evidence, there is really no evidence to support that China even engages in like debt trap diplomacy. And like in my article, I talked about like the three general problems with this like debt trap diplomacy myth. Like, first of all, despite all accusations, China has never seized an asset because a country defaulted on a loan. And I can talk about like the two most commonly used examples and talk about like why that's false in a few minutes. But full stop, China has never seized an asset because the country defaulted on a loan. The next problem with that myth is that it assumes China unilaterally dictates Belt and Road Initiative projects to lure these countries into taking out these predatory loans in the first place. But Chinese development financing is largely recipient driven. So the borrowing countries determine their own infrastructure projects based on their own political and economic needs, and they work in partnership with China to finance them. So it's not like this, it's not quite this relationship of exploitation and hapless victimhood on the part of the borrowing countries that U.S. politicians like to portray it as. The borrowing countries are treated as partners because the way that China sees it, you know, especially in Africa, a developed Africa is good for China business-wise in the long run. The next problem with the debt trap diplomacy narrative is that it relies on this assumption that it's Chinese policy to advance predatory loans with these like kinds of term, these like predatory terms and conditions to ensnare countries into debt. But in reality, China often advances loans at fairly low or even zero interest rates. And it's often they're often willing to restructure the terms of existing loans to be even more favorable to the borrowing country. Sometimes they forgive loans altogether. And these loans, they often have like decades long payment plans. You compare that to IMF loans that often have like very high. So you have the interest, but on top of that, you have like the really high additional interest fees and really high surcharges on top of that. And, you know, all of these like fees and surcharges kind of lock developing countries into these cycles of debt, which they can't really like ever dig themselves out of, which means they keep like borrowing more and more IMF loans, right? So like in August of 2022, the Chinese government actually announced that it was forgiving 23 interest-free loans in 17 African countries. And prior to that, between 2000 and 2019, China had also restructured a total of about $15 billion of debt and forgiven $3.4 billion in loans they had given to African countries. So, you know, they talk about how, you know, places like Africa, you know, they're so deeply in debt because of Chinese loans. But viewed relative to Africa's overall debt, Chinese loans are only a fraction of what they owe total. Chinese debt in Africa actually accounts for like 12% of all debt. And Chinese loans are really not a major contributor to debt distress in Africa. And there was like this 2018 study that was carried out by the Debt Jubilee Campaign that found that over 2/3 of the external debt that Africa owed was to multilateral institutions like the World Bank and other non-Chinese private creditors. So if you want to talk about debt traps, you can't, you know, you have to talk about the lending practices of Western financial institutions or their allies. So,
yeah. I mean, like, the whole West dollar system is one colossal debt trap. Like, it's a trap. Like, that, like, the dollar, people give real things. They give food and commodities and cars and like, you know, cell phones and whatever. And they get back pieces of paper with the merit, with, like, you know, George Washington's face on them. Like, and they don't even get paper anymore. Like, it's just some number somewhere. Like, that's the crazy bonkers system that the US has created, and that's why it's so rich. Now, like, this system, however, like, if you think about it in some ways, that like this is the trap itself is the dollar, because you're feeding into this monster your national goods, and then you have to take that dollar and bring it into your own economy, right? And so that makes you liable to that thing called an exchange rate, right? So, like, guess what's happening to the Turkish lira right now? And I mean, I've always felt this way. I mean, apparently it's not the right correct assumption. Someone once corrected me, and I'm supposed to do an episode on actually, but like, I can't help but feel that the fact that Erdogan, I mean, my own instinct is to feel that, like, the fact that Erdogan is taking over his own independent foreign policy, that lo and behold, we're seeing this collapse, this insane collapse of the Turkish lira. And the Turkish lira, it's an export oriented economy, right? And so it hurts that's the system. Like, that's the sensitivity that you build when you create yourself. Like what the U.S. wants is for countries that are not the U.S. to take up position in the global supply chain. And that, yeah, Turkey, supply us your apricots, your apples, your fruits, your this, your that, and you get back some paper, and we'll let a chunk of your elite come and study in our universities and live in our coastal cities. And, like, that's what you get. Like, that's the exchange you get. And, like, the people who own the land that those resources come from, they get rich and it works out for them, and they're the ones who send their kids away. But ultimately, you're taking goods outside of the country and you're giving them to someone else, and you're getting back nothing. Like, you're getting back a dollar, right? Like, and that's the crazy thing. And the fact that the Chinese have built an alternative system right? The very existence of it is a mortal threat because the US requires monopolistic control, right? Like people need to read Lenin. People need to read Lenin and read the essay, like imperialism or the highest stage of capitalism, right? Because that's the highest stage. Because you've extracted all from the industries, the capitalism has evolved to the highest point where you then move outwards and extract resources and recreate those like parasitic relationships, but at an international level, right? That is just not happening between China and its trading partners. Whatever you want to say, yes, China is a global power. Yes, it is a nuclear power. Yes, it is the world's largest country. And with all of these facts, it does constitute a superpower. However, not all superpowers are built the same. They're not the parasitic, and this is the key thing, it's not the parasitic, like violent, like rapist, colonial, like genocidal US, UK, European empires that all congealed over the last 500 years to give us our modern world. Like it's truly, truly something different. And I've said this before on this show, I feel, that like the strange, perverse, like, I mean, the irony and like historical irony really blows my mind that it's the Chinese and the world that they're creating that is actually more in line with like the liberal dream of capitalism. Like the liberal dream of the market is to create a world market that interacts with each other. And this market is one of equal exchange where value is exchanged for commodities. But of course, we know that in the U.S., that's not how it's been working. We know that the reality is that it's an unequal exchange and that resources are, they flow one way and money flows another. And this is like how it goes. And the extractivist principle and, you know, like that's it. And like the fact that our punditry class and our intellectual class and our supposed radical class too, they need to project onto China the same things that their country does every day that they don't particularly care about. I mean, this is the crux of the matter, is that anything that we think that other bad countries do, the US does like to the power of 10 or 20 or 30 or 1,000, right? Like that's the root of all this. So that like, if you're upset about like Iranians, like getting killed by police, boy, do I have something to tell you about the great Satan. Like you can, like, this is like a, this is, and the fact that like the difference though, is that you hear a lot about one and not about the other, right? And this is the critical difference. And the fact that you hear about, you know, the economic relationship between China, a powerful country, and countries that are not as powerful, and then you get so much panic and like, you know, hand-wringing, and yet you don't hear about the fact that like Mexico is not a sovereign country. Mexico is run as a province of the US. That like the US just basically shut down, for instance, one example, the US shut down the flow of avocados for like a week because one of their food inspectors like got harassed or something or threatened, and they got really mad and they shut the borders, right? Like, I mean, it probably didn't destroy anything, but like that's what the US can do. Like the US is the cop of its trading relations, and it is like the master of its trading relations, and all of its other partners are just its vassals. So the fact that like other countries are not pursuing this, then it's not all the same. Like this should be, I don't know, this should be something that we should take seriously, and we should like not just require, just not fall into this like trap, really, to use this word, of thinking that the world is like us, that the world is run like the same way that our rulers run the world. Because it really isn't. It really isn't. Like it's just such a like a gross and cheap and like, you know, illiterate thing to say, that like to compare the scale and the like just the outright theft of resources and everything, and then multiply that deep into time, right? Because it's not just the US, because preceded that was France and like England and all those things consolidated. Like, where did France get its gold from? To all these people who are wringing their hands about Chinese debt trap diplomacy. Like, why does France have any gold? A country which had no gold deposits suddenly has a huge amount of gold. Gee, I wonder why. Like, because that's the nature of European like imperialism. It's extractivist. When China starts to acquire the traits of Europe and America, then we could talk about Chinese imperialism. But until then, I don't see how we can like not laugh people out of the room when they talk like that.
Right. I mean, if you want to talk about like what imperialism is in 2022, 2023. It is the export of finance capital and granting, you know, developing countries these loans that are conditional upon, you know, reforming their entire economy to benefit Western capitalist interests. That's what it is.
It's a mafia. It's a mafia. It's exactly what the mafia is. Like, the reason why people like The Sopranos, because it, like, teaches them about, like, how the U.S. does business around the world, and they don't know it. That it, like, extracts wealth, bullies people, forces them into their worldview, and recreates their world. I mean, it really is what Marx and Engels said in Communist Manifesto. They want to recreate the world in their own image. So, yeah, they show up to Greece in the 2000s, in 2008, and they say, oh, you want to survive this crisis? Well, your public system is going to have to be as shitty as ours. Your public schools are going to have to be, like, burning to the ground, and you're not going to have any public hospitals just like us. You know, your pensions are going to be shit just like us. Like, that's what they did. Like, how come Greek doesn't, Greece, even lowly old Greece, like, how come they don't get the sympathy? But, like, this is the, like, recurring thing of, like, the imperialist worldview, is that you get to pick and choose which, like, who are the victims and what stories the victims get to tell, while the other people can just, like, shut the fuck up and die slowly and take up your position.
Yeah, I mean, you can... No, it's okay. You can... I mean, there are, like, loads of examples of predatory IMF lending, but I just want to talk about a really salient example for right now, right, that we don't really, like, talk about too much. It's not, like, too well known. You look at, like, the exploitative extractive relationship of, you know, Western creditors in the IMF. Just look to the IMF's relationship with Ukraine beginning from the mid-1990s until now, right? They have tried to pry open that country ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They have tried to pry open that country to Western investment for a really, really long time. And, like, in recent years, especially since the coup in 2014, it has just become, like, an experimental playground for neoliberalism. You know, like, I think, like, the IMF loaned the country, gave the country a $3.5 billion loan immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Then in 1998, you know, another $2.2 billion loan. 2014, a $600 million loan. 2008, a $16.4 billion loan. And, you know, as I said, like, all these loans are conditional upon, like, certain economic reforms that they have to implement, right? And in 2010, the IMF was supposed to give Ukraine a $15 billion loan, but held off because the government failed to pass legislation approving the reforms that were conditional upon the granting of the loan. And the loan was conditional upon, like, the removal of gas subsidies and cutting back workers' pension plans and, like, all these kinds of tax reforms. And a lot of these reforms failed to pass. So as a result, the IMF decided that that Ukraine needed to implement even more economic reforms, and they'd get less money if they were to receive another aid package. And this war right now that's going on, it's making Ukraine even more indebted to the IMF and the EU. And because of this increasing debt trap that Ukraine is ensnared in, the country is now even less able to refuse the neoliberal and austerity demands of Western creditors, right? And so, like, why is the IMF, why is the West interested in Ukraine? Ukraine is known as the breadbasket of Europe. It's home to a lot of fertile land. The IMF's main interest in the country lies in its agricultural sector, right? Ukraine, right, is, like, the third largest exporter of corn and, like, the fifth largest of wheat. And so, you know, this interest in its agricultural sector was part of the reason for the 2014 Maidan coup. So, like, what led up to the coup was, like, in 2013, then-President Yanukovych was expected to sign this EU trade agreement deal. The country was in, like, pretty deep financial and economic crisis. It was about to default on its loans. And this EU deal would have integrated Ukraine more fully into the Western economic sphere. And it would have severed a lot of the cultural and economic ties to Russia, because Yanukovych still had, like, ties to Putin and stuff. So this EU trade agreement deal, there was a $17 billion IMF loan that was tied to this deal. And at the last minute, Putin stepped in and offered them like a $15 billion aid package, including a 33% discount on Russian gas. And so Yanukovych decided to go with that deal instead of the EU trade agreement. And this was pretty consistent with Yanukovych rejecting IMF loans due to a lot of the conditions that were attached to them, right? In 2010, he had vetoed, like, some tax reforms that was part of the austerity package of another IMF loan. In 2011, his government vetoed a pension reform bill that would have raised the age of retirement for women. I think, like, it would have also, like, they wanted to cut public spending. So because of this, because these were vetoed, the IMF put the loan on hold. And so after Yanukovych signed the deal with Putin, there was a U.S.-backed coup, the Maidan uprising. And after that, after Yanukovych was overthrown, they installed a more IMF-friendly president, Yatsenyuk, right? So the month following the coup, Yatsenyuk signed the EU trade agreement, and it was put into place. And, you know, along with the EU trade agreement, of course, came the IMF loan deal, and the IMF forced Ukraine to reform its natural gas price subsidies in exchange for the aid package. So as a result of that, Ukrainian citizens saw, like, a 50% increase in natural gas prices. And the EU trade agreement also opened up Ukraine's agricultural sector to the use of biotechnologies, despite the country prohibiting the use of GMOs, you know, since 2007. And ever since then, and especially since after the war started, we've just seen, selling Ukraine, or what's left of Ukraine, just selling it off to Western capitalist interests. I think, like, there was, like, a story a couple weeks ago that said, the Ukrainian government had signed a deal with, is it BlackRock, where they signed an agreement so that it would do a lot of the rebuilding after the war is over. So, you know, like, this is like a key component in the war, and, you know, like, why, you know, there are certain interests in keeping the war going and wanting to destroy the country so that, you know, like, these Western corporations can go in later and rebuild it. Like, there are, like, very lucrative deals here and a lot of money being made by people. This is, like, the, by definition, 100% a debt trap. But China agrees to give Sri Lanka money to build a port, a commercial port. And, you know, we say that's a debt trap.
No, this is solidarity. We're doing solidarity with Ukraine, Amanda. Excuse me. That's the solidarity of the West, is that they'll sing your praises and like make the Quisling man government like a hero on your screen, and a bunch of people will put the flags on their cars, and like, you know, there'll be a couple signs here and there. But ultimately, this is about making money destroying the country and then making money buying what's left, the rubble and the land underneath, and then making money rebuilding the country for the people who are left. And in the meantime, you know, you got to kick Russians out of every, you know, international federation. You got to extend the proxy war. You got to like employ all your fail-son, you know, like writers and pundits at the, you know, whatever think tank. Like it's a racket. War is a racket, and it keeps our economies alive here. And our pundit class is correct in how much they act, is in how much they agitate for war, because they're correct in recognizing that it feeds their own careers. It feeds the coffers of the monsters who pay them. So like, that's the system. We are like a parasite monster, like they just siphon money off of the world and they use war to do it because it's the most lucrative. There's no more lucrative like industry than war, because like there's like these stories. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, what's interesting though, I mean, I guess this is all not interesting, it's terrible, but like the strategy of the Ukraine versus the strategy of Russia, like Ukraine has, like, because it's an American ally, it has the ability of like Western banks to like print money, or Western governments to print money, which are then given to their choice weapons manufacturers who make these munitions, and then they fire them off 30 at a time against a drone that cost a few thousand bucks. Like the Iranian drones like cost in like the less than 10,000 like pennies, like comparatively speaking, and people are firing $100,000 like interceptors at them, and they're missing, by the way, or like $50,000, like millions of dollars. And this is the same story in Palestine too. In Palestine, you have like millions and millions of dollars being spent on like a few pennies worth of rockets built by people under siege. So that, like, if you can't see like what like that situation is, and like you think of this as like, oh, this is an occupation and like ethnic struggle, it's not. Like, this is commerce. Like, this is how our system works. It's very cynical. It's very evil. And anyone who like, and like these things about like debt trap diplomacy are just like, they run interference. Like the entire Orientalist panic machine that like just runs the gamut, from you know, like North Africa to like Venezuela or whatever, across to China. Like that's not how the world works, I understand, but whatever. But like that machine is so like vast, and it runs all day and has unlimited fuel, and like they can say anything, they can do anything, they can like make up any kind of story. Gordon, like just yesterday, like Joe Rogan, the stupidest human to ever walk the face of the earth, he has this like insane China conspiracy guy where he's like making all these like crazy, and like millions of people are listening to this. Millions of dumb, impressionable men, mostly men, because that's Rogan's audience, although not entirely. He's a popular guy. He's a dumbass, but he's like an open-minded dumbass. But the thing is that there's so much gullibility and so much credulity when it comes to China and North Korea and Iran, that you can make this stuff up, that you can turn this stupid nonsense phrase debt trap diplomacy, and you can turn that into like there'll be books written about it. People are writing their dissertations on it right now. They're going to get PhDs, and some of them will get jobs like in academia because of that phrase that like Mike Pence used in his speech. Like, that's what's so fucked.
Mm-hmm. They'll get tenureship at Ivy League institutions. But like before, I also wanted to debunk, you know, a couple of the more commonly pointed to cases that people often use as evidence of China's debt trap diplomacy. So when I published this article and I posted it online, invariably, I would always get, you know, these like dumb liberals who thought that they were like countering what I said by linking an article to the New York Times about Sri Lanka's Hambantota port. And Sri Lanka's Hambantota port is like the one case that's always used as evidence in support of debt trap diplomacy. This was where the term itself originated, right? Like, as I mentioned like a few minutes ago, the term came about in an Indian think tank paper when it was talking about Chinese lending for the Hambantota port. So the conventional story is that Sri Lanka wanted to build a port on their southern coast in this village called Hambantota as part of the Belt and Road Initiative. And the story goes that Chinese banks then granted Sri Lanka these loans, again, with like very high interest rates and very onerous terms and conditions, with the assumption that the government would eventually default on the port. So they lent them the money knowing that they would default. And when they would default, China would seize the port. Well, when they, as the story goes, when they did default, China seized the port as collateral and built a naval base there to extend its military reach. So that's the story that's often told. It's spread by U.S. politicians. It's told by U.S. media. But the story itself is false. So again, Chinese development financing is, you know, largely recipient driven. So Sri Lanka had the idea for the port, not China. And it was actually an idea that Sri Lanka had for several decades, way before the Belt and Road Initiative even came into fruition, like decades before that. Sri Lanka didn't even approach China to finance it initially. They first approached the U.S. and India, and both the U.S. and India rejected the offer. And it was only after that that the Sri Lankan government approached China. And so a Chinese company, China Harbor Group, won the contract. They won the contract, and a Chinese bank agreed to fund it. So, you know, the Hambantota port was not a Chinese proposal to begin with. And on top of that, this all occurred in 2007, which was 6 years before before BRI was even launched. So over time, the port ended up being a commercial failure. And around this time, Sri Lanka was embroiled in a civil war, and it was experiencing a lot of economic problems, and it was going through like this financial crisis. It was deeply in debt. But this financial crisis was more due to Western financial lending than Chinese lending. So in 2017, Sri Lanka had like over $50 billion in external debt, only 9% of which was owned by China. And the government, like I said, owed more to the World Bank and Japan than to China. And due to Sri Lanka falling into debt, the government arranged a bailout through the IMF. And because the Hambantota port at that time turned out to be a commercial failure, the Sri Lankan government decided to lease it out to an experienced company in order to get foreign cash reserves to pay off the debt. So the government of Mahinda Rajapaksa, who was president at the time, they first approached Indian and Chinese firms, all of whom rejected the offer. And then after that, it then negotiated with China Merchants Ports Holdings, which was a Chinese state-owned enterprise, to lease the port for 99 years in exchange for a little over $1 billion, which they then used to pay off their debts. So, you know, a lot of details there, but basically the country never defaulted on the Chinese loan. And there was also like no debt for asset swap here, as the story goes. What happened was that the port, you know, it wasn't seized at all. But what happened was they kind of put it up for sale in order to raise money, allowing Sri Lanka to use that money to pay off its other debts and deal with other issues. And again, as I said, a lot of Sri Lanka's external debt at that time was owed to Western creditors like the World Bank, and also owed a lot of money to Western allies like Japan and India. And, you know, like another false claim that's often made about the Hambantota port was that China seized it for military purposes. You know, the story goes that they seized the port and then they built like a naval outpost there. And this was like kind of spread by then President Mike Pence at the time, who, you know, said publicly, you know, he said that the port would soon become a forward military base for China's growing blue water navy. That's a quote. This never happened. Sri Lankan diplomats and politicians, you know, have insisted publicly that China using the port was never featured in their talks with Beijing. And, you know, like the ambassador of Sri Lanka to China, you know, even said in a CGTN interview, he said, China never asked us, we never offered it. And, you know, Chinese naval ports or naval ships aren't permitted to use the port at all. And it's for Sri Lanka's naval command only. So that is like the one that's usually the most common example of cited as evidence of Chinese debt trap diplomacy. Another example is like something that happened a little bit more recently. It was like sometimes people cite the Entebbe International Airport in Uganda as evidence of Chinese debt trap diplomacy. And what happened was, like, in November of 2021, one of Uganda's national newspapers, they like ran this article with a headline that said Uganda surrenders key assets for China cash. And the article basically said that unless the government of Uganda, you know, renegotiated some of the terms in this contract for expanding Uganda's Entebbe International Airport, the country was at risk of being forced to hand over the airport if the loan was not repaid. And this, the loan in question was like worth $207 million at 2% interest from the Export-Import Bank of China. And China had granted Uganda this loan for expansion of this airport, which was a project under Belt and Road Initiative. And because this story was run, it was picked up by a lot of Western media outlets. The headline went viral on Twitter, and I can send you a clip of this, but The Daily Show even aired a segment covering the story as the latest example of China like colonizing Africa and ensnaring African countries into these debt traps.
Back in the day, when one country wanted to take over another country, they had to beat them in a war, or they had to rent the other country on Airbnb and then just never leave. But now, it looks like a country might have found a way to take over another country with the stroke of a pen.
China's recently been accused of trying to take over Uganda's Seoul International Airport if the East African country fails to pay a $200 million loan for the expansion of the site.
At this rate, if Uganda fails to repay the loan, Uganda's only international airport will soon be a Chinese asset.
In response to the public outcry over the loan agreement, the Chinese embassy in Uganda issued a statement saying, quote, "Not a single project in Africa has ever been confiscated by China because of failing to pay Chinese loans."
Wait, China might be threatening to take Uganda's airport because of a loan that might not be paid? And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but that statement was not the most reassuring thing I've ever heard, because we've never confiscated an airport is very different from we're never going to confiscate an airport. Like, if you ask your spouse, promise me you'll never cheat on me, and she says, of course I promise that up to now I have never cheated on you. Oh, she's going to cheat on you. And I know what you're thinking right now. You're like, I didn't even know Africa had airports. First of all, f*** you. We've had them since the 90s. And secondly, you're probably wondering, what the hell is going on with this story? How can one country take another country's airport? Do they just take over its operations, or do they actually get one of those claw things that just scoop it up and then take it back to their country? And if so, can they do that to LaGuardia too, please? But maybe the biggest question is, what is China even doing in Africa in the first place?
So after that, it was also like picked up by other media outlets like the Wall Street Journal. Like a few other outlets as well. But it was a viral story. But nobody really looked into the terms of the agreement. This organization called ADATA, they ended up obtaining a copy of the contract and they looked through it. And according to the contract, the airport was not even a source of collateral that the lender could seize in the first place. So there was like really no way that China could seize this airport as part of the agreement. What the conditions of the agreement did require was that cash collateral be placed in a separate escrow account, which could then be seized in the event of a default. But that's like a fairly standard clause for international projects financing. And so this story like went viral and it like, had a life of its own. And like I said, the purpose of like these kinds of stories, it's like doesn't matter if they're true or not. The purpose is in the circulation of itself, to repeat it over and over again until people accept it as truth, so that when people actually do the research to debunk it, it's like too late at that point because everyone has already accepted it as truth. And no one, believes you that, it's not true. So it led to the spokesperson for the Uganda Civil Aviation Authority to get on his Twitter account and deny the allegations of Chinese plans to seize the airport. I think his name's like Vianney Lugia. And he tweeted out, he said, I wish to make it categorically clear that the allegation that Entebbe Airport has been given away for cash is false. The government of Uganda can't give away such a national asset. We have said it before and repeat that it has not happened. There isn't an ounce of truth to it. And that's the first post in this thread of, of him denying that China seized the airport or, they even could seize the airport to begin with. But, despite all evidence the contrary, the damage was done and people like had it in their minds that this airport was seized as part of China's debt trap diplomacy thing that it engages in. So, despite all evidence to the contrary, that didn't stop media sources from spinning their...
When did evidence ever matter to imperialists and people in the West? When did the truth ever matter to them?
As long as feels right, then it's the truth. It's correct.
As long as it aligns with 500 years of Orientalist fiction. Like that's all that it needs. And they win, they have inertia on their side. They have historical inertia on their side by in all these different things. Like they get to call you get to say anything about North Korea for the same reason. You get to say anything about the Iranians for the same reason. That Orientalism provides this kind of pillow, this ideological pillow that all these obviously fake stories have to land on. And then the credulity factor is weirdly inversely representative of like how little criticism you have for your own government in all of this, for their own, and how ignorant you are of like their own sort of like policies. And like anybody who talks about death trap diplomacy and like doesn't talk about like Lebanon, like Lebanon is like, they are starving Lebanon of dollars, and they have been doing that to punish the country for Hezbollah. And it's been that way forever. And they like made it, they designed it that way. They made the country function on dollars, and now they're denying dollars to the country. So you can't do anything. And like, no, who wants the Lebanese pound? Like, what are you going to do with the Lebanese pound? Like nothing. So like, and especially because they had this war, a proxy war again, like a global proxy war on this poor little country, all their industrial base is destroyed. So they can't like make anything for themselves. So they have to buy something, but how can they buy it if they don't have dollars? Like, this is the crisis that global South countries go through, that like millions of people go through. And the fact that like our pundit class once again would rather invent things than to talk about the actual realities that we are perpetrating. I mean, I always say this too, like China could be like, Chinese people could like run rampant across the globe for like 10, 20 years and like murder their way across the globe, and they wouldn't even hold a candle to the Europeans. Like, they wouldn't even, it wouldn't even be close. Like, same thing with Iranian police. Iranian police could like go through a rampage, and it wouldn't even be close to like the kinds of things Americans could do. But because we live in this world, like because the imperialists enjoy monopolistic kind of discursive control over how we view and analyze everything, that this gets overlooked, and it always gets flipped onto them. They're like, oh, look what China's doing. Look at this terrible thing China's doing. And we're in this position, not we, I mean, you and I, but like people who have the like a modicum of skepticism are put in the back foot position of having to respond and debunk. But in the meantime, like, who's listening to us? We're just like cranks. We're like the fringe. You know, we're like the fringe of the fringe of the fringe. Like, even most like big left podcasts, like I would say most big left podcasts would agree with most of the stuff that gets said about China and the world and the mainstream media. And they're happy to get like take. Like, that's easy. Like, you know, even that's on, like, even our supposed, like, whatever. Like, so I feel that, like, the onus is on the deck is stacked against us from the beginning. And all you can really do is just, like, laugh and, like, point out these things in this kind of meta environment. Because if you're going to, like, stomp out every single fake story, you're going to go crazy. Like, you're actually going to go crazy. Like, people who do this, like, I see there are kind of people online who do this about Iran or other countries. Like, they're just like, they're like fake news pointer outers. And I mean, I respect it because it's hard and you have to be like dedicated and you have to be like, you know, who's one of them actually? Aaron Maté. Aaron Maté is like the most like principal, like he's like a no. Like, he takes the stories and he like reads them and then he like debunks them and he like tries to do it in the term that like liberals supposedly stand for, which is like rationalism, whatever. But of course they don't. And, you know, like Aaron's very like effective. But in the end, like, he still gets the hate for what he does, because like in the end, like, they don't care about the facts. Like, it's just their agenda. They hate Putin.
You weren't muted the whole time. You were muted for like the last minute or so. But
oh, that's weird.
You were talking about Aaron Maté being one of the...
Yeah, I must have clicked. I must have clicked something. Oopsies. Oh, sorry, Aaron Maté. I'm going to have to clip that part out. It won't make sense to anybody. But Amanda, it's been over an hour. What are you working on, and what's coming up for Radio Free Amanda?
I think this will be... Well, I don't want to, like, knock on wood. I think I'm going to be working on like some more articles, so look out for that. For Radio Free Amanda, I'm going to be interviewing a few people from Youth Against Displacement, which is this like really good org in New York City. They do a lot of work against displacement and gentrification in Chinatown. So they're going to talk about that particular struggle, but we're going to situate it in the context of like academics who, you know, like NYU academics and Columbia academics who study China and study labor in China, but have nothing to say about workers in Chinatown being exploited and have actively gone against them and supported the Museum of Chinese in America, which it's a long story and it's a little too much to get into, but it's going to be a really good episode about how academics uphold imperialism while still studying the global South. And, you know, it's like, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and it's just like very strange, isn't it? How the US exports a bunch of academics to like developing countries to like study like labor conditions and like workers in China, and then like come back and then like write monographs about them and like basically build careers off of them.
The East is like a career, baby.
Like, it's just
that's where the title comes from.
The East is a career. You don't see academics from, I don't know, like Ghana or like China or anywhere else, like, you know, coming into the U.S. and doing field work here, doing field work among Amazon warehouse workers, and then like going back
Europeans and writing monographs. I've known Europeans who do it, but yeah, it's the same. You're right in the sense that like there is this human flow of people, and then the opposite flow of knowledge, right? That like you like extract knowledge from these people. I mean, and this, I know, again, another example from Iran. There's lots of nasty. There's one particularly nasty one. He's, you know, just, oh God, wretched. It's. Academia is a lot of things, but we won't get into that. Thank you, Amanda, friend of the show, friend of the podcast. It's great to have you on, and looking forward to talking to you again.